The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. This is News Dissector Radio, starting a little late, but we've had a terrific conversation. We have some wonderful guests, David Wiley and Greg Mitchell, joining us here in the next hour on News Dissector Radio. So please stay with us. We'll try to move right along.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo.
Well, that's from my film, In Debt We Trust, made in 2006, warning of the financial crisis and later getting me tarnished as a know-nothing, a doom and gloomer, because I didn't know what I was talking about until the market smelted down. Suddenly I went from being a zero to a hero in some circles, somebody who sort of was on top of this financial crisis. But my passion and a lot of my interest over the many past years has been less on financial journalism and more on the media itself and journalism. I edit MediaChannel.org, which is a website now in its 10th year, struggling on to try to offer a variety of perspectives globally on what's happening to the media. And one of the people who was in the mainstream, which is slipping into a mudstream, and who's now with Huffington Post and has been a leading critic and analyst of media, is going to be joining me now, along with Sherry Welch. Sherry, are you there?
Yes, Danny.
Good. Sherry's here, and so is Greg Mitchell. Greg Mitchell is an analyst and writer whose work has been on target. We both wrote books about the media coverage of the Iraq War, and Greg has been really doing an excellent job. I just start off with a media topic du jour today, Greg, to get your take. I see you've written about it on Juan Williams' firing by NPR for remarks he made on Fox. What's your take on that?
Well, it's you have to kind of separate the what some people have said the rather poor handling of it versus whether it was right or not. And I think there's probably some people on the left who wish it hadn't happened because it just deflects attention from more important issues. Feeds the right wing paranoia about the mainstream media and so forth. So it's almost like you want it to go away. You don't care enough to make a strong stand about it, and you kind of want to wipe it out. But there seems to be kind of a consensus that what he said was wrong, and that he should have been made to choose right at that moment. Say, okay, look, you cannot work at NPR anymore if you're going to work at Fox. And maybe then he would have chosen Fox, and it would have been over and done with. Instead, you kind of have a bit of a mess on your hands. So.
Well, there are two developments here. My partner, Rory O'Connor, in the Media is Plural blog on Media Channel, basically indicts Bill O'Reilly for sort of provoking Williams. And Williams was sort of deflecting to him and trying to say, yes, Bill, I agree, but, you know, I've written about civil rights and, but I do feel uncomfortable when Muslims come on a plane that I'm on and et cetera and so forth. There just seems to be so much pandering to the audience, particularly on Fox. Being politically correct there is important. But there's yet a new development today that Howard Kurtz has written about, namely that apparently George Soros has made a $1 million-plus dollar donation to NPR to help them fund new reporters. And this has led Sarah Palin and others to basically say that this proves somehow, that NPR is now a tool of the liberals, and she is calling for the elimination function of NPR and all government and funding support for NPR. So now the whole network is being challenged on the basis of this one grant. Now,
right.
People on the left have always thought, like, NPR is National Petroleum Radio, that it has not been consistently balanced. It has not been the sort of independent radio source that it should be, and neither is PBS. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has just put out a new study on PBS showing how with the loss of Bill Moyers and the Now program, it's moved in an even more conservative direction by and large, and it's criticizing the political maybe centrism or center-rightism of public broadcasting. But nevertheless, symbolically, it looks like Juan Williams now emerges as sort of a martyr for the right of free expression.
Well, you know, the problem has been that, and what most people will not get in the reporting is that NPR has had longstanding problems with him. And again, not even ideological, but just the fact that he, you know, he's been warned over and over to not be, you know, not be so opinionated on Fox and other appearances, that he's an NPR analyst, which in their lingo means he's supposed to be kind of right down the middle and not betray his opinions too much. Now, there's a lot of writing going on the web and elsewhere that is saying that NPR's whole philosophy is, you know, is bankrupt, and we shouldn't make any sorts of demands on analysts or people not to express their views. So that's kind of a separate issue. But the fact is this was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of NPR putting up with his work on Fox. But that's going to get lost, and it's going to be painted as strictly an ideological thing, and NPR so liberal, and they couldn't stand one sort of uncomfortable comment.
Well, a lot of this has to do with, I believe, Williams' basically sort of laziness. You know, when you're on a number of channels and you're constantly punditizing, whatever the word is, you know, you end up just sort of recycling opinions of various kinds for your audience and for the audience you think that's out there. And Williams, you know, has made a whole career of doing this. His early work as a reporter and, you know, analyst on the civil rights movement has sort of given way to this role, you know, of being sort of the sort of black pundit expert kind of person who, in many cases, you know, has sort of waffled on so many issues,
right,
and cleaved to the middle and to the center. And many people thought he was on the Talk of the Nation on NPR. I got a letter in my blog today on mediachannel.org from a radio reporter who said he did a lousy job on that show. He contrasted his work with Ray Suarez, who did a much better job in his view, is now with the PBS NewsHour, and said, you know, he was really kind of disappointment, you know, in NPR. So I'm sure there's
right.
a lot of internal rivalries there and frustrations with his prancing about from network to network. But unfortunately, this topic, this will be seized upon, as it already has, by Sarah Palin et al., to try to mount a frontal attack on public broadcasting, which is something the right has been doing for many, many years. And public broadcasting's defense has been to move to the center, to try to avoid any suggestion of independent, critical journalism in a way, and certainly analysis. And I think there was a big relief in PBS Central when Bill Moyers finally retired, and they didn't have to fire him, which I think many times they would have liked to have done. So, you know, that's where we are right now. Public broadcasting is sort of anemic, less than, you know, really a competitive force to commercial broadcasting. And Juan Williams becomes the poster boy of all of this and will now wrap himself in the mantle of the First Amendment.
Well, I think that's true. And of course, the right, didn't say anything in recent months over other assaults on the First Amendment. They only care about the First Amendment or cite the First Amendment. I mean, the First Amendment doesn't even apply here because, as we've seen, Juan already has a new $2 million contract at Fox, so he's hardly been silenced. It was really funny for him to refer to that this was, you know, he was handled being handled worse than what happened during the Nixon era. And of course, during the Nixon era, he not only did Nixon clamp down on reporters, but actually threatened to kill Jack Anderson and so forth. So have the FBI investigate them and so forth. So it shows how out of whack this is. But the problem is, of course, the hypocrisy on the right and the hypocrisy on Fox News, which, you know, is hitting NPR's lack of balance when, you know, no major outlet's more imbalanced than Fox News. So, you know, it is kind of laughable on many levels.
But again, we live in an age of perception and symbols, not in an age of facts and realities in some respects. And as a result, it's easy to sort of redefine this issue as an example of them liberals, you know, basically not willing to have somebody with a more critical perspective. You know, ask Alan.
But this isn't anything new.
Go ahead, Sherry Welsh, reaction.
There's a great quote that I found about Greg Mitchell, who's the author of a new book, The Campaign of the Century, Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor of California and the Birth of Media Politics.
Well, you beat me to introducing him that way, but go ahead.
If 76 years ago, the media frenzy, voter intimidation, and character defamation that characterizes today's elections is a hallmark of these modern times, no, think again. And Greg, why don't you tell us about what happened to Upton Sinclair?
Well, you know, most people know him only as the author of The Jungle, and maybe some other books later. But
one of the great muckraking books of its time,
right?
Would you say?
But you know, he not only went on to write dozens of other books, but he was during his most of his lifetime, he was one of the most famous authors, always in and out of the headlines. You know, getting arrested, leading various protests, and he was the most famous socialist in, around the world for many of those many of those years, and quite a controversial figure, but someone who was one of the more famous public figures in America. But what most people didn't know until I really started writing about it a few years ago was he ran for governor of California in 1934 as a Democrat, and not only ran but won the Democratic nomination in a landslide, leading the greatest mass movement in the history of California, called End Poverty in California, or EPIC, and was really favored to win the election as governor that November. But the Sinclair threat was seen as so severe that the vested interest went out and invented the modern political campaign as we know it today. And that's why the book is called The Campaign of the Century, but the subhead is Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor and the Birth of Media Politics.
Well, you know, this is very important because, of course, historically we've had, you know, a media that has been mostly in the center or on the right and hostile to progressive ideas of all kinds. But here was a man who not only talked about issues but organized people. EPIC, In Poverty in California, was an amazing undertaking. Many people saw it, you know, as really, in many ways, a model for how people can organize. And curiously, it may be that it's the Tea Party today that's using some of those same techniques,
right,
not to end poverty, but to actually promote, you know, a kind of plutocracy in America, the very values that he opposed. But tell us a little bit more about what happened on the media side in his race.
Right. Well, as you said, his grassroots organization was really incredible around the state. In fact, they started their own weekly newspaper called the Epic News, and by primary date it had 1 million circulation, and by the election it had 2 million. This is in a state that was much smaller than it is today, that's for sure. But in terms of the media, basically when Sinclair won, which was at the end of August of 1934, basically all the business interests, the media interests, various political factions, and Hollywood took its first plunge into politics, all against Sinclair. And what they did, and what you know, why it was the birth of the modern campaign, was that they felt they couldn't trust the the anti-Sinclair campaign to the Republican Party, which had always been, you know, political parties always ran campaigns then. And so they took it outside the campaign and turned it over to political consultants, which hadn't been done before, advertising experts, publicity geniuses, or what we now call spin doctors, national fundraising for a state race, which really hadn't been done before. And Hollywood, led by the rather saintly Irving Thalberg, created the first attack ads using the screen, which in these cases was the movie screen, which are the precursors to all the television attack ads we see today.
So that's we should just remind the audience, Thalberg is one of the people who's honored every year at the Oscars
with
a special award as a man of conscience and the like.
Right. And then elsewhere in the media, the book just chronicles this incredible, I mean, in times very, very, sometimes very funny because it's over the top. All the California newspapers led by the Hearst papers and by the LA Times, just had an incredible, campaign against Sinclair. I mean, they ignored the campaign, except when they were attacking it, and they were attacking it every day on the front page and running, excerpts from Sinclair's books, to make him look bad, and editorial cartoons. Everything was, you know, Sinclair and his supporters as maggots and socialists and communists, and, you know, if anything, they should be locked up, not, you know, running for office. And it really was, in terms of the press, I mean, you could read the book just for the all the coverage of the newspapers back then and the incredible way they covered or didn't cover the campaign. And again, it was the dirtiest campaign in the history of California, you know, to this date, and one of the dirtiest in the entire country.
Where did FDR... I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sherry.
Greg, why was Upton Sinclair viewed as such a threat?
Well, he had been a socialist. There's no, you know, it's not like with Obama where they say, well, he used to be a socialist, and there's, you know, absolutely no evidence. I mean, Sinclair was a member of the Socialist Party for many years. He changed his affiliation to Democrat. He had a firm plan called the Epic Plan, which sketched out what he wanted to do, which was basically turn over idle farmland and factories so that people could get to work, because this was the real depths of the Depression. People have a wrong idea today. They think Roosevelt came in 1932 and waved his magic wand, and unemployment started plunging, and we were on the road to recovery. But sort of much like today, you know, Roosevelt came in, got some things done, wasn't really all that as bold as people think. And, unemployment had gone down, but it was still horrific. And so Sinclair basically was running from the left, but not from the kooky left. It was, he was saying put people to work in idle factories and farmland. He proposed old age pensions, which didn't exist then.
Well, where did FDR stand on all of this, on the Sinclair campaign?
Well, FDR, it's one of the running themes in the book, is FDR's deliberations. You know, he was basically, were two factions, many, including his wife, who were pushing him to endorse Sinclair. After all, he was the Democratic nominee. FDR was, you know, had trouble getting things done, and they wanted as much Democratic support. Sinclair was falling all over himself to offer support for Roosevelt. He wasn't backing away from Roosevelt. But the other faction said that you know, Roosevelt was already being called a socialist, and what would happen if he endorsed Sinclair, and, this would be terrible, so he shouldn't do it. So it really kind of went down to the wire, and amazingly, Roosevelt ended up sending an emissary to California who made a deal with the Republican candidate, the right-wing Republican candidate, in which Roosevelt said he would refrain from endorsing Sinclair, but in return, the Republican had to come out for, you know, certain parts of the New Deal after his election. And so they made this deal, and sure enough, the Republican won. And then after he took office, he did come out with, you know, friendly statements about the New Deal. And, you know, Sinclair was sabotaged.
This sounds a lot like developments today, doesn't it? With sort of an equivocating White House,
right,
a refusal to support the people who are most supportive of the Obama administration, backing away from, you know, the calls for a national moratorium on foreclosures, calls to get tougher on the banks. The Obama administration has sort of resisted all of that. And also, it's sort of dismantled one of the greatest grassroots organizing campaigns in a presidential race. The people that actually put him in power, you know, which was supposed to be continued under Organizing for America, and was sort of you know, put on hold more or less.
Yeah, they're frantically trying to get it together now. Now with 2 weeks left in the campaign, but it might be a little late. But yeah, I mean, and the thing with the Sinclair campaign was that, you know, he really stood for something. He had the plan that was laid out. He had the principles that were, could not be compromised. And that led the supporters to be, you know, be so enthusiastic. You compare that with Obama, who, you know, said he was for public option, but then gave it up, barely without a fight in the health care. So, and what happened with the, you know, and because Sinclair kind of held to his principles, the Epic, although his he did not win, dozens of Epic candidates won for state legislature in California, and in fact it turned that it really was the basis of the modern Democratic Party, which had been conservative to that point, and these legislators completely turned the whole state around. One of them was elected governor in 1938. Sinclair's running mate in 1934, Sheridan Downey, was elected senator and served two terms. Hollywood was forever turned to the left by this campaign because the actors and the writers and others there were so outraged by the Hollywood moguls' tactics that they really swung to the left, and it's been sort of allegedly liberal ever since. So because the Epic campaign was so strong and grassrootsy and stayed grassrootsy, it had an incredible effect, and also had an incredible effect on Roosevelt, who, after the election, and thanks to the Sinclair vote and the vote of you know, some other elections around the country, then felt bold enough to then move more to the left, propose Social Security and many other programs, which were not part of the early New Deal, but came about after the you know, the elections of 1934.
Well, you know, writing in the New York Times, Bob Herbert concluded one essay by calling on all of us to take our cue from the best moments in American history, when the nation rolled up its sleeves and placed the interests of ordinary people at the top of its agenda. And I think this book offers that history. Greg Mitchell, thank you so much for coming on. Greg writes the Media Fix blog for The Nation. His book is called The Campaign of the Century. It's won a book prize. It's been published by Polypoint Press in a new edition. And his other books, including Tricky Dick and The Pink Lady, So Wrong for So Long, Why Obama Won, and with Robert J. Lifton, Hiroshima in America, are also available as ebooks. So, Greg, I hope people will rush out to read your books. And I really appreciate your coming on. I'm a big fan of your work, as you know, and I appreciate it.
Well, I've been a fan of your work for many years, too. You know, we've had a mutual admiration going on for a long, long time, and I appreciate it. And I would only urge people, when they look for the Campaign of the Century, look for the new edition. You know, there's a previous paperback and previous hardbacks and so forth. So if you're searching for it, you know, make sure you get the new edition, which is just out this week.
So there you go. Greg Mitchell, thank you. We're going to be back with David Wiley. We're going to be back with a whole other range of issues. Stay with us on News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network.com.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong. Indeed, criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops. And bank walking is AAA. Grandpa knows his 401k.
You are listening to PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Another song from In Debt We Trust, and you heard earlier the theme song of Plunder, done by Polarity One, Polar Levine. There is a collection of these songs online at our website, PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com. You can download it and check out the full song. Anyway, our next guest coming to us from the city of Cambridge in Massachusetts, the city that I lived in for some time in the Boston area. Our guest is David Wiley. He's the author of City Save Thyself. He's a Boston lawyer who became an advanced man in a presidential campaign, a county chairman, a lawyer for the Boston Redevelopment Authority, general counsel of the Massachusetts Housing Finance Agency, a Coast Guard officer. He worked for the Navy Department, Internal Revenue. Look the other way, David. Over 14 years, he was an elected school committee member and city councilor in Cambridge. He lives in Bolton, Massachusetts. Now, thanks for joining us, David. Sherry, why don't you say a few words about having David on?
Well, David's written a very interesting book, and of course, all politics is local. And he wants to talk about building a world of enforced law and how we really have terrorism in our own hometowns. Do you want to talk about that, Mr. Wiley?
Well, this book tells the targeted populations, you know, to give up being targeted and go to work for self-salvation. It says, make the nations, use your cities and towns to make the nations get rid of the weapons of mass destruction. I start from the premise that the nations have had 65 years since Hiroshima. We still have the weapons. Because of terrorism and nuclear proliferation, we're in greater danger than ever. And so let's exercise some survival techniques and get the human species working on its own behalf.
Well, how do you feel about the various communities, I believe, of Cambridge at one point and others who've, you know, called themselves nuclear-free zones, who've tried to raise larger issues about the world, about military spending, about law enforcement, at the local level? You know, it was, of course, Tip O'Neill from Cambridge, who's quoted as having said, you know, all politics is local. But can we integrate those two dimensions, the local and the global?
I think we have to, because, after all, policy follows power. And so if we, the targeted populations, want to get enough power to protect ourselves and create security in the world,
we've got to get the power to do it. And the one place where power is still accessible with enough work is the cities and towns. You know, you really can't get power at the national level. Sure, you ought to vote every 4 years for president. You ought to vote for Congress and so on. But if you work at it, you can get real power in the cities and towns. And if enough cities and towns did it, particularly if they worked across national borders, then they could bring real pressure on the nations, you know, that might finally overcome the power of the arms manufacturers and all that.
I noticed that you have an interesting blog, Idea Ransacker, which is a great name, and in it, you know, you talk a little bit about some institutions in Cambridge, like MIT, which you know, has been part of the whole national security system for a long time, at the heart of what you call the war establishment's academic agenda. So tell us about that. How do you, in a local town, you know, try to restrain some of the academic institutions who are being pumped up with all sorts of Defense Department spending? And, you know, this is also, of course, very true in Cambridge. The Draper Labs have been there. The various Center for International Studies was notorious as being a supporter in the early days of the war in Vietnam. How do we try to bring some public accountability to this type of effort?
It's a power struggle. It's a political power struggle, and it needs a lot of people to self-select themselves to do it. Back in Cambridge, it's been a long time, but a referendum was got together to ban nuclear preparation of nuclear weapons, work on nuclear weapons, storage of components in Cambridge. It was to be a referendum, and in the spring, two-thirds of the voters were shown in favor of it in a poll. MIT created a spin-off of the Stark Draper Laboratory, where nuclear weapons are made, and they hired a California publicity firm, and they turned public opinion around. By the fall, two-thirds of the voters voted against this referendum. So it's not easy, and you're up against money. But power can be gotten if you elect yourself, or you elect friends and supporters on city councils, boards of aldermen, town select boards. And if we do this across national borders and put pressure on all the nations at once, then nations lose their you know, excuse, we can't get rid of that weapon because somebody else has another weapon, and so on. And you put pressure on all the nations at once.
Now, you know, Massachusetts has a history, of course, as the cradle of democracy. The town meetings there are well known. But somehow, you know, grassroots democracy seems to have collided with established power and has had its impact eroded by that. Now, as somebody who worked on the inside, David, as a city councilman, as on the school committee, what were some of the obstacles and pressures you faced in trying to raise and push forward a different kind of agenda?
The biggest problem is people settle for what I call supplicant democracy. The people who want change, armed in this particular context, arms control advocates, peace advocates, anti-war advocates, they like to go out and march and hold signs and so forth, and I've done a good bit of that myself. But I call that supplicant democracy. It's trying to change the minds of the powers that be. You know, you go to lobby your congressman, which a lot of us has done, and a lot still gets done. You go out one door, who walks in the other door but somebody who gives jobs, making weapons and profits, you know, to a lot of people. Who's that congressman going to listen to first? And he doesn't have a lot of choice. You know, and the same is true in the White House. There's not one president, not one prime minister, who can really politically put himself in a position of saying the things that have to be said to start the long movement away from the war system toward a world of enforced law.
I mean, we see that, you know, since he left the White House, Jimmy Carter, for one, has been very engaged with all sorts of global issues and global peace and, you know, making controversial statements at points, but standing up for his principles. The problem here is that I think a lot of voters, Obama supporters, for example, somehow believe that he would be able to basically change things, you know, from the inside, starting on day one, and he wasn't able to do it in part because he's up against this power of this military-industrial media complex.
That's right. What it would take would be some president who would, to himself, make the promise, when I get in there, I will say and tell the public everything that needs to be said and done, even if it means the certainty of my not getting a second term. And they can't do that because, you know, you owe too much to the thousands of supporters and the thousands of people who've contributed to you and to all the people within your own party who are running, say, for Congress and that sort of thing. And you can't sabotage them by coming out for something radical. The point is, sure, enforced peace as a world goal is a radical goal. I say, think 50 years ahead. I challenge everybody. I think this is a very important exercise. Sit down, think 50 years ahead, and imagine that it's a secure world. Not necessarily a peaceful world, because there has to be law enforcement and there will be limited wars, but a secure world on the whole. And then write down, well, what are the components of that? And then say, well, what are the first steps? And the components, clearly, you're going to come up with, you have to have the same basic law enforcement mechanisms we have in virtually every country of the world, which is you've got to have administrative arms, judicial arms, and police enforcement arms. And you've got to have enough democracy to keep that accountable. And
let's talk about that for a second, that word accountable. What does that actually mean? I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of people who work in government and then suddenly find the police running amok one day, breaking the law, violating people's rights and the like, and they feel sort of powerless. They need to defend them on the one hand because, you know, they're running the government, the cops work for them. On the other hand, to try to restrain these police is very difficult. I mean, an incident in Cambridge with a professor and you know, who was trying to get back into his own home.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah.
And he was arrested. You know, it's probably one of the best known black professors, you know, in the world. Okay. And, you know, the policeman who was supposedly had been racially sensitized didn't know who he was and didn't really care.
Well, there's no question that the police excess is a huge problem. I mean, the people who have been against global law enforcement, they talk about black helicopters. That's one of their favorite themes. And they're right. That has to be taken into account. You can't just go and create an international army, arm it, and leave it with nothing better than the UN to guard over it, because the UN is really just an agency of nations. It just reflects the nations. And so you've got to have something that's inherently globally democratic, not a global president, but you've got to have global democracy. And what I'm trying to say in this book, City Save Thyself, is that we ought to be getting a slot on our municipal ballots, on our city and town ballots, to directly elect from the city or town a representative to a cross-border global security council or congress of cities and towns. And that would create, or begin to create, as soon as just a few cities do it from a few countries, that would begin to create steps toward the global democracy that would then make global law enforcement feasible for the first time in history.
Well, for, you know, two thoughts on that. One, could the UN benefit by having, in addition to a Security Council and a General Assembly, an assembly of people, of elected people from around the world who are there actually to promote a people's agenda as opposed to a nation's agenda?
That's absolutely right, and one of the things I say is that this this global Congress of cities and towns, directly elected from cities and towns, could evolve into first, say, an advisory council for the General Assembly, and then it could morph or evolve into a replacement for the General Assembly, and then you begin to get real control of world events on a democratic basis, instead of through the nations.
You know, listening to you now, you know, I realize that how little visionary thought, how little kind of outside-the-box thinking ever creeps its way into the media, where people, you know, basically say what Bobby Kennedy said, I see the world and I ask not why, but why not, you know? What makes it so difficult to get a discussion going, a conversation going about the issues that you're raising? I mean, it seems to me when people hear it explained to them, they respond positively.
Boy, I really scratch my head over that one all the time. I say that I talk about the survival instinct. We're right down to the wire here, the human race. The Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, which is a successor to the 9/11 Commission, they came out with a report in October of 2008 that said that they predict that some city in the world will be struck by weapons of mass destruction within 5 years. That was 2013, and then a year later, in 2009, they came out with a follow-up that was entitled "The Clock Is Still Ticking," down to 4 years, and they say the same thing. And now we're down to almost barely 3 years.
Well, this is interesting.
So the danger is huge.
This is interesting, though. We see it in all the denial of global warming on the right, for example, a refusal to acknowledge these challenges and problems,
that's a good analogy.
Keep the status quo going. And, of course, this danger is something that has been warned about and has been talked about for years.
And people know it in their guts. And that's why we have, on the entertainment scale, and the movies and the TV, you have increasingly, you know, these sci-fi things, and in religion you have this end-time religion where, you know, everything's coming to an end on Earth. We know these problems in our guts, and we've got to externalize it, and we've got to think about it, and we've got to say to ourselves, we've got a big brain. That's where we've got, you know. Did we sacrifice our survival instinct that all animals have because of our big brain? Well, we'd better use it.
Any other thoughts, Sherry, that you'd like to raise?
I think that it's a very interesting book, and I've read an excerpt from it, and I want to thank Mr. Wiley for what he's doing and bringing to the attention that what you said with corporate media empires block nations from giving us what we really need. And what you're saying, I really loved your comment about supplicant democracy.
Well, there you go. I mean, Sherry is really on top of this, and I really appreciate your recommending David. David, can I just ask you one little political question about Massachusetts? Is Barney Frank in trouble there? Do you foresee a further swing to the right because of this Tea Party movement?
I sure hope not. He put up $200,000 of his own money yesterday, saying he had raised plenty for a conventional campaign, but he was going to have to put his own dough in because he could see some pretty rotten tactics coming up at the end. So sure, he's scared, and I think that all Dems ought to be. And let me just say about my book that I've got a website, citysavethyself.com, www.citysavethyself.com. And anybody who's interested, that'll lead you to how you can get it and more about it.
Well, you know, thank you very much, David, for joining us. There's a couple of other issues I need to move on here. Folks, you can hear this program as a podcast and in the archives of ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be posting it in my blog on mediachannel.org, thenewsdissector.com/blog, which I've been updating a lot because of this foreclosure crisis. I would also, you know, basically invite you to comment, you know, on the show. We don't get a lot of calls, but I know we do have listeners out there, and you can write to me at Danny@mediachannel.org or dissector@mediachannel.org and share your comments and suggestions for guests and other thoughts here on the show. I do want to acknowledge one comment by a very astute listener last week who heard some noise emanating out of me, out of my inner Danny, certain could be called, I guess, a burp. And I've asked Matt, who is an expert burpologist, to kind of share with me what you think a real burp should sound like. There you go. Okay, thank you. We'll try to watch that. I'm trying to watch it now, and I appreciate even criticisms on that level and feedback, because we want the show to be listenable and listenable as well. I wanted to say a few words about this foreclosure crisis. First of all, starting with a report in The Onion, which sort of speaks to part of all of this. It says, micro lender forecloses on goat. Representatives from One World Finance, a U.S.-based microcredit provider, confirmed Monday that they had initiated foreclosure proceedings on a goat in southern India following a borrower's repeated failure to make her $2.20 monthly loan payment. I tried to work with Mrs. Thagan on this, but when she fell a full $6.10 behind, I had to repossess the goat, says loan officer Michael Conrad, who stated that he was just doing his job and that it was not his fault if certain subsistence farmers were living beyond their means. I left to recoup the entire $22 loan at auction, but given the glut of foreclosed and abandoned goats in the area, I'd be lucky to get even half that. Pretty funny, perhaps, until you read a story just in the press yesterday about a farmer in India who committed suicide because of the pressures of his debt. So this is apparently very common there. People are losing their ability to pay back. They're falling further and further behind. In the website Seeking Alpha, which is one of the financial websites that I look at, a fellow named Jeff Nielsen, who's in the actual financial services industry, says, as the most massive systemic fraud in the history of human commerce continues to unfold before us, there is no lack of topics and issues while we poke through these cesspools of Wall Street slime. By now, everyone has heard ad nauseum the announcement of U.S. fraud factories that they were suspending foreclosure proceedings in 23 states. An automatic question which rises from these announcements is, what about the other 27 states? Yet despite the severity of the acts, which we already know, most of these fraud factories are still steaming ahead with getting corrupt judges to rubber stamp systematic and systemic acts of fraud in more than half of the U.S. states. We heard on Gary's show, Michael Hudson, who's in my film Plunder, talk about this and how illegal and blatantly corrupt many of these foreclosures, I call them fraud closures, are. I write about that in my website and in my blog at thenewsdissector.com/blog. But it really, this is an issue that affects everyone. If you're not a homeowner, it affects you too, because if a home is foreclosed upon, property values go down, and it affects the entire neighborhood. Services are cut, the tax base shrivels, and people are in a worse situation than ever. And what we're seeing across the planet is more and more attempts at austerity in England, particularly. Paul Krugman writes about this in the New York Times today, and it's a very interesting column. He talks about how half-baked and half-assed the British economic strategy is, which is going to cut 500,000 jobs at the very time that they're telling us that an economic recovery can only happen if there are more jobs. So they're going in the absolutely opposite direction, creating, you know, a situation of a more severe economic crisis in England. And I was just in London, you know, was told basically the government is the largest employer in the UK, the number one employer. So what happens, you know, when you start cutting all government spending? You end up with what? More unemployment, more misery. And, you know, a lot of people are surviving on, you know, very little money and really very little food. And this is going to lead to, I think, just death on a massive scale for poor people in England. And it's already happening in our country with the, expectation, you know, life expectations going down, America dropping down in world terms, in terms of economic prosperity, so many countries doing better than we're doing. And now we want to go to war with China, which is economically doing much better than we are, and has basically been used by the United States to buy our debt, to buy our treasury notes. And if they stop doing so, there's going to be not only a currency war, but a trade war and potentially a military conflict. So this is something that we have to pay attention to, folks. This is not about somebody else. It's not about people we read about, you know, who are losing their homes. We are all losing our economy. We are all losing our futures. Our kids may not have schools to go to. I mean, it's all that serious. School teachers getting laid off and fired, and, you know, various public employees as well, with a right wing basically cheerleading for this. They want to see more cutbacks. Sarah Palin wants to cut National Public Radio. She wants to cut all government spending. And this is this illusion somehow that the, quote, private sector, the free market, is going to be able to create new jobs. They're not doing it now. The Chamber of Commerce is spending literally hundreds of million dollars that they don't disclose the funding for in our political race. And we're in a situation where, you know, today the Wall Street Journal basically said, well, the number one funder of our elections, not the Chamber of Commerce. Oh, no, the Chamber of Commerce that Rupert Murdoch just gave $1 million to. Of course, it's not them. It's the unions. And so this game of trying to essentially deflect our attention, distract us from what's really happening, is continuing. Progressive Radio Network is attempting in a small way to actually challenge this, to raise important issues. I come on the air every week, but I write every day on Media Channel. Sherry, what's it look like where you are in Georgia? Do you think the right wing is going to be, you know, kind of gaining a lot of seats? Certainly Newt Gingrich does.
Well, I don't really like to talk about Newt Gingrich. I think he just opens his mouth and says it all for me. But what's really happening is the racism that's running rampant. They had a city councilman actually that told a black city council person they got into an argument down at Warren Robins and said, you need to be out in the cotton field.
Well, there you go. Can't get too much more blatant than that. The Onion, you know, speaks to the way the Republicans have basically been waging this campaign of basically boasting about how many seats the Democrats will lose, and hoping to make it, you know, make their prediction, you know, a reality. And, you know, the Onion picks up on this in its current issue. I'd just like to share this with you. Democrats could lose up to 8,000 seats in upcoming midterm election. According to recent media reports, Democrats stand to lose as many as 8,000 congressional seats and more than 917 gubernatorial races. They're poised to pick up 1,500 seats in Ohio alone. You know, this is a commentary on the lack of facts that sort of drive our politics and drive our elections. So you can challenge that. You can inform yourself. Please read MediaChannel.org. Follow the show, News Dissector Radio, Fridays at 1 here on the Progressive Radio Network. We thank Gary Noll for this opportunity. We're going to be going out now and hoping that you'll join us in Harlem at the Maisel's Theater on 127th 28th Street, October 26th, for a screening of Plunder. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week, I hope. Thank you.